Susan, you ready? All right. The House Committee on Revenue will come to order, and we'll open our information meeting for January 23rd, 2009. This morning, we're carrying over from our meeting on Wednesday with school finance. Steve, you ready to continue?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, Steve Meyer with the Legislative Revenue Office. We ended the Wednesday with this slide about the equalization formula and with the specification for each of the four grants that make it up. I wanted to just touch bases with a couple of more comments about it. We didn't really say anything about what happens when state revenue, for example, decreases in this process. If state revenue goes down, do all school districts take a loss first? And you would expect so, looking at this formula, but that's not the case. There's two or three districts that would not have any loss in state school fund revenue because they don't get any to begin with. Their state school fund dollars are zero. Their local revenue is more than sufficient to add up to the sum of the four grants. What does happen is that, assuming that transportation costs don't decrease, that grant doesn't change. The other two, the facility grant and the high-cost disability grant, are maxed out. And so all of the decrease comes out of the general purpose grant. Okay. What happens is that ratio that balances the sum of the grants to the revenue available decreases to accommodate the reduction in state revenue. Same would be true if it were local revenue. Okay, so there's only four things then that when you look at the dollars per weighted student and compare two districts, there's only four things that make that dollar per weighted student different. One district could have qualify for construction cost dollars. It could qualify for the high-cost disability dollars. It could have higher transportation costs per student. Or it could have a different teacher experience factor. Those things are what drive the differences in the dollars that you see on a per-weighted student basis. So it might be a few hundred dollars usually, but those are the four drivers of that difference. You can see from this slide that the general purpose grant is over 95% of the total. That's what makes the weighting of the students so important, right? Because that's what divides up that 95%. Going back to the chair's question about why are the weights important? Overall, it really determines how much that district is going to get. The transportation grant, about 4%, and the other two, under 1%. Okay, just a couple slides about history. You can see here the dollars divided up between state school fund, local revenue, and state other. As you go across, you see the blue bar portion of the bars declining. That was a phase-in of Measure 5. The white portion at the top of the bars is currently the school improvement fund. Prior to that, it had different names, classroom needs, and a few other designations. But there's been a gap in there being any of that extra revenue. On a per-student basis, you have the same pattern. You had a couple of years where it was down. So just because of the economic situations at the time. So if it goes down again this year or next year, it won't be the first time. This is what has changed since 91 in terms of the overall effect of the equalization formula. In 91-92, there was a great disparity on revenue per student, anywhere from maybe $3,000 on up to, and if all of the districts had been included, it probably would have gone up to $8,000 or $10,000. Now, when you see the slightly horizontal line, 06-07 revenue per weighted student, not flat, but almost. Again, those small differences are because of those four factors that alter dollars per weighted student. Okay, education service districts. Don't want to say too much about these. The general logic is that ESDs provide services to school districts and their costs are related to school district costs. so that the formula weights that take into account these costs can also apply to ESDs, so make ESD revenue proportional to the revenue of their component school districts. The formula takes the sum of the formula revenue for their component school districts, multiplies it by 4.987%. That gives you the 4.75% of their share of the total pie. That is their base revenue. So that this portion distributes all of the revenue available to ESDs. But there's also the factor in the statutes that each ESD is guaranteed $1 million. So it's their base, so they get the higher of their base revenue times a slight reduction percent to balance because of that $1 million being above their base revenue for five districts that received that. And so it's either $1 million or about 99% of the base revenue. ESD revenue follows the same pattern as the school district revenue. The one difference that this illustrates is that in 1991, ESDs did not receive any state school fund dollars. Right? Prior to that, they were funded strictly with local dollars being property taxes. Okay, a few of the other sources, local option property tax. You've talked about the local option already. What's different for school districts in terms of the local option, there's a maximum amount that they can raise without it becoming considered local revenue in the school formula. Okay. So if the school district goes out and raises more than $1,000 per student times the number of students, any excess above that becomes local revenue in the school equalization formula. In effect, it doesn't benefit them to do that at all, to exceed the limit. Local option elections haven't been real successful. Currently, it's about 41% of those offered passing. The districts may be hesitant to go out for a local option if they think it won't pass. There's also equalization for local option grants. I'm not going to go into this. What it tries to do is level the playing field for those districts that have local options and have different property value per student. So it basically says that if two districts go out to raise or have the same tax rate applied to their local option, they're guaranteed about the same dollars, even though their property value is much different on a per student basis. So it's just another way of leveling the playing field because of the differences in value per student. Okay, just a couple things. Construction tax started passed last session. It can be imposed by resolution, not by a vote of the voters. It's restricted to capital improvements. The rate is capped at $1 per residential foot, 50 cents for non-residential, but those rates are indexed. And then there's various exemptions. School improvement fund, don't have to say much about that because there probably won't be one. But it does get distributed between school districts and ESDs the same way as the formula dollars are. Initially, it was all for school districts, but then ESDs got their share. And it's distributed proportional to weighted students. Districts do have to apply. And
we've actually done it twice, isn't that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
In 01-02 and then 07-08. Districts have to apply. I think there's a few that don't go to the trouble of applying because of the limited amount, but most do. Okay. Now, this section, I'm done with the formula, unless there's questions. I just put some numbers together using the numbers in the governor's budget for illustration purposes.
Go ahead.
Very quickly here, the school improvement fund in the governor's budget is $6.39 billion. No school improvement fund dollars. Remember, some money is taken off of the top of the state school fund. So for the 09-11, it's about $34.7 million. That leaves a little over $6.3 billion for school districts and ESDs. The local revenue for school districts and ESDs is added to that to get a combined total of $9.35 billion, a little over $3 billion in local revenue. All right. Then you do the split between school districts and ESDs. The school districts get their 95.25%, which is the $8.9 billion. School districts get their...
Would you back up just one
sure.
slide? Is that the gross amount or the amount that comes from the state? From the school fund.
Mr. Chair, the $8.9 billion is both local and state.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. The ESD share is $444 million. And then that's it.
Thank you. Questions, comments? Of course, the last bunch is the governor's proposal, and the Ways and Means Committee will work with that for the next several months, along with other options.
Mr. Chair, you might want to say something, Steve, about kind of the local revenue picture, how that's looking.
Mr. Chair, local revenue, the assessed value for this last year came in higher than expected. We were estimating about 4.6% growth rate. The preliminary numbers are about 5.2%. So that raises the base that you're going forward on. So it basically increased the local revenue in the first year, 09-10, a little bit. But we also reduced the growth in assessed value in that second year of the biennium, which then lowered that amount from what we had been thinking for the second year. And then I also reduced the collection rate overall, because just given the employment factor and foreclosures and such, it just makes sense that not the same amount percent of money will be collected right away. So making those changes, the net result was about a $5 million reduction overall for the biennium. Not a great change yet. But what we'll see is whether the preliminary estimates of that 5.2% growth rate hold up. That becomes actual. And then we'll have to see with the new forecast what happens to construction employment, housing starts, et cetera, and determining whether to reduce that local revenue component more or not.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the update. Steve is available as we are working on issues involving school formula and, of course, other things as well. So please, members of the committee, make use of his extensive knowledge and experience. Paul?
Mr. Chair, the next item we have on the agenda is on transportation. So we got transportation and tobacco. So are you going to do tobacco first or transportation?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mazen Malik, Legislative Revenue Office. I was doing excise taxes.
Okay.
And then transportation as part of that. At the time when we have the transportation section, I have a guest also from the past, from my past. He's still very much present, I guess. And we will talk more about this VMT charge kind of thing that has been much in the news and in the proposal for the governor. But to go and quickly reintroduce these issues to you and just remind you, in the Legislative Revenue Office, we have different functions and different things. My portfolio includes a number of different things. Sometimes it's described as everything that is not property or income tax, and everything else, basically. And, of course, a lot of people accuse me of being the vice guy. Of course, we keep saying that, you know, somebody's or one person's vice is another person's fun and nirvana, if you will. So I will, if you basically smoke, drink, or gamble, I would do those. I'll do transportation as well. If you need emergency at 911, I will help you with that. And then, of course, the if you need a hotel room, I'll tax you as well. And the most depressing part of my portfolio is that when you die, I'm still your guy. But we won't talk about the state tax today. We will talk about tobacco, about alcohol, about telecommunication, fuel and eight mile, and then transient lodging tax.
You had fun with this, didn't you?
Sorry.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Berger.
Don't we have some rule about having fun with moving screens and things in the revenue department? Economists have a certain shtick they need to keep to, and
right.
Serious purpose and not having
right.
fun with
the proper robes and the proper demeanor is very
yeah,
important.
Yeah, right. But
right.
But Mazin's into sin, so we'll let him get away with it.
I suppose so. Representative Gelter.
Mr. Chair, I just want to put on the record that I remember from last time there were sound effects, and that's why I came today.
And pictures.
I had high expectations for sound effects.
Mr. Chair,
I will say that before I met Mazin, I didn't realize that economists had a sense of humor.
I know.
And before I met Mazin, I didn't know that there was such a thing as moist snuff or a hookah.
So he's been an important part of both of our educations. Please go ahead.
I have to apologize for the sound effect. It's a function of this computer. It seems it doesn't have to, just can't do it for some reason. There was sound effects in here, and I'll try to describe the sound effects. Come and try to do that. So the tobacco revenue is two parts. Cigarette, other tobacco products, and then you have one big segment out there is the master settlement agreement. Cigarette tax rates, the cigarette tax rate have changed through time. In 1996, we had measure 44, and that have increased the tax rate. In the past, it used to be a certain level. It took it to a 59 cents. Now I need to be precise about the language here, so I'm bringing this out to make sure that I don't leave you with the wrong impression when I'm talking about the tax rate, because you will not see cents in the statutes. In Measure 20 in 2002, it increased the tax rates by, although it says 60 cents, and then to $1.28 at that time, the statute describes this in mills. And a mill is a tenth of a cent. So if you would look at the statutes, you would find that it is a mill per cigarette rather than a cent per pack. In the year 2004, as part of Measure 30, you remember Measure 30 was the Sessions rebalance attempt and change in revenue, and it went down to voter referendum, and it failed, and with it, it took down the 10 cents that was temporary at that time. That 10 cents that was the Oregon Health Plan segment of the tobacco tax that was exclusive. Measure 50 in 2008. Measure 50 is the one that we sent to the voters in 2007. That did not pass.
Representative Gelser?
When that dropped in 2004 with Measure 30, is there any other state in the country that has lowered its tobacco tax in the last several years besides Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I don't think so. Although I'll check into that, but I doubt that this happened. I think everybody else was going the other way.
Great, thank you.
If you look at the different states, that might be an answer to you. As of January 1st, 2008, Oregon stands at number 22 with $1.18. If you add the sales tax to the excise tax, because that makes a difference since we don't have the sales tax, many states add the sales tax on top of the excise of $1.18. Oregon falls back to number 26. Now, the 2007-2008 revenue number is, I found it to be very interesting that it's 222.2. Is that a coincidence? Perhaps. But.
Oh, Lord.
It divides that way. Health plan gets the lion's share of the tobacco revenue at 69%. General fund 23%, local 5%. Local includes city, county, and the transit. This is the elderly and disabled transit. Tobacco use reduction account. Now, the these distribution proportions, it is important to see how those work, because if you at any time start looking in the statutes and get that to be a part of the work that you're going to see, or we expect to see more of this session, the tax rate is in two segments in the statutes, and that is a result of the different times that you have different legislation. The first segment is a 58 cents, and that's called the permanent, and it's ORS 323.030, and it divides in, as you see, the general fund with general fund 37%, health plan, and local, and so on. And then the second segment that came in 2002 is a 60 cent, and this was mainly dedicated to the health plan. The amounts that went to the tobacco use reduction or to locals was an amount in order to compensate for the reductions that they will see as lower consumption occurs. So that in order to maintain them or keep hold them harmless from reductions that might occur.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I may. You talk about to compensate for the reductions that occurred. Can you tell me what kind of reduction did occur?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, I will show you in a slide that is coming the amounts that would be looked at different times.
But the object, as I understand it, was that all the new money would go to the health plan. The reason it divides this way is to keep the other parts of the program whole with the reduction in consumption that comes from the increased cost of cigarettes resulting from the tax.
Mr. Chair, I could not have said it any better.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Call.
Can we also, maybe not now, but at some point, I'd like to see this commodity compared to others. It seems to me that there's always been talk of addiction being a driver that makes the commodity less elastic, makes it so it fluctuates less with regards to price increase from taxation. So if we could talk about that too. Or maybe you can comment on it now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hull, I think that's, I'm sure we will have time. There is a proposal to increase cigarette tax, so that we would be looking at that intently. Last session, We had a lot of work with this issue. Some of it was more, how would you say it, involved than I would have liked. But for the most part, we've touched on this, and we do have a lot of information about the elasticity of cigarettes. Cigarettes or tobacco is one of the issues that have been studied extensively. We actually have series and time series and data extending many, many years and spanning many, many states. So that is something that we can accommodate.
The I wonder, I'm not certain that Representative Call meant this, but it would be interesting to get some sense as to how elasticity works with a drug like nicotine that is addicting, and compare it to some other commodity that isn't addicting, and how use changes based on price changes, and how they're different if they are. I think that may get it, perhaps, at what Representative Call was talking about, but it's certainly something I'd be interested in knowing.
And that is part of the question as well, for sure.
I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Call, the elasticity that comes out on the consumption and the price elasticity of nicotine perhaps is it's like the Pegasus. It's already in the addiction element, since you would think increases of that swings in prices would produce a higher level of price elasticity than it does otherwise. At this time, we look at about 0.6 elasticity. With other commodities, you would expect it to be higher. 0.6 is almost inelastic in that sense. So for every 10% increase in price, you look at 6% decrease in consumption. It's not even unit elastic for that reason. So that has already almost been figured into this elasticity estimates.
I wonder if there's increased elasticity based on price for the beginning of the use of this drug. And if there is, that might have policy implications for us. I'm not sure that's something we want to talk about right now, but it's something that might be useful to know about for later, since I know we will be talking about some bills that are not really designed to raise revenue, but they are designed to discourage young people from beginning the use of nicotine products.
Well, and I would love to talk about them, Mr. Chair. Unfortunately, I'll be giving up smoking this session.
Mm.
Well, you gave it up last session.
Congratulations.
You and President Obama.
Well, yes. Actually, that I have given up already. I'm talking about smoke tax. That will be Dave's new.
Dave's going to get it.
Dave Beck is a new smoke guy. We thought, everybody comes into the office, needs a little bit, this is what they call hazing.
Only an economist.
So, but I will supply Dave with all the resources that I've had before.
Thank you very much.
Just to put the picture in a little slightly easier way of looking at it. And put it with the ORSs. Remember, this is the total tax, the 118, and these are the two segments of the tax, the 58 cents and the 60 cents. The 60 cents, this is the new one, divides, and this is the way it's in the statutes. I mean, this is how interesting the layer over layer of the statutes. It does not change in cents or percentages. It says 29.37 over 30 of that amount would go to the OHP, and 0.21 over 30 will go to tobacco use reduction, and 0.14, and actually it goes even more into that. Now, the other percent, or the other amount, 58 cents, which is 29 mils per cigarette, and this is 30 mils per cigarette, goes in a percentage distribution. That's a little difference. 89.65 to the general fund and 10.35 to cities and counties and transit. But then out of the general fund amount, you get 51.92 of that to the Oregon Health Plan and 0.577 to tobacco use reduction. Probably any legislation that comes this session, hopefully we will have a way to simplify all of this and put it as straightforward kind of thing. And that will permanently take me out of the job. Now, the tax revenue forecast, this is a forecast that comes from the Office of Economic Analysis, where they the forecast of the different things in the state. We have this is what we saw with Measure 20. This is the amount of revenue. Remember, the amount of revenue have already taken the increase in taxes with the consumptions and so on, and overlaid it with all the taxes. Measure 30, this is the 10 cents reduction. We saw no change. No change in tax. Usually it would, the trend is down, but this reduction have just maintained revenue the same. These are the different amounts and numbers. Now, the way we're looking at this and all this reduction, this is as a result of the smoking ban that took effect January 1st of this year. In 2009-11, of course, this is still going on this year, the this biennium, 2007-09, at $431.3 million. Remember, this would decrease the next or the coming 6 months. So it's only 6 months out of the biennium that are included in the smoking ban for this biennium, for the current biennium.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Mazin, are you going to mention the Washington effect here?
Not today, Representative Berger, but if you like, I
would you define the Washington effect for those who are not aware of the Washington effect?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, Washington and Oregon seem to be so. Of course, smokers don't necessarily think of borders as a place where they throw back their old pack of cigarettes and go to the other side and buy the other one. They'd go for the bargain. And it seems like Washington and Oregon, because of the big population centers all along the border, there is this effect of the tax amounts moving back and forth. So if you have restrictions in one side and less restrictions on the other side, smokers seem to migrate from one side to the other and vice versa. Unless we put guards on the border or the smoking police anytime soon, it seems that there is this, what we call it, the Oregon-Washington smoke dance, and we have graphs to probably show you next time. They will show you graphs next time. We say, since I'm giving up smoking, remember.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you don't mind, a quick question on that subject, and perhaps I should save this for day. But if you look at the your fifth and sixth slides on sales excise tax rates across states, something I noticed earlier, that the two highest tax states are Rhode Island and New Jersey, and I'd be hard-pressed to come up with two states that have probably more cross-border connections than Rhode Island and New Jersey. And they happen to be right next to New York and Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, that are all a couple of tiers down in their tax rates. So are these smaller states, Rhode Island and New Jersey, are they able, to the extent that you know about their policies, are they able to have such high rates because they have less of a Washington effect for some reason, or do they have to have higher rates in order to compensate for the leakage of revenue from their taxes across the border?
You know, it's a great question, and I'm glad they will be answering that for you. But no, it is the effect does exist, of course. All these, and that's why sometimes I think, for some reason, I think those states have
I don't know if it's coordination, but it seems like their tax rates are closer to each other between, so you would find New York and New Jersey and all these, and they do figure all that movement within, and you could see it in their numbers. You actually could track the revenue numbers according to the differences that exist. As I said, tobacco and cigarettes and the study of it has been one of the most extensive or the rich areas of study of revenue economics, black markets, and so on, because it is profitable, first of all, and then you have this incentive for black markets to make profits. And you do, if you always hear about all these trucks from the different states going, filling up in one state with cheap tobacco and driving all the way up to a different place. So that is almost well documented. And that's a big job of the federal government, frankly. The ATF, one of them, it's most preoccupations is the smuggling and the contraband and cigarettes and so on. So these issues are really interesting and daunting. And as I said, I'd be happy to give it up.
Representative Call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last question to follow up on Representative Berger's. So the Washington effect or the dance that you talk about, it seems to me that Washington's tax is significantly higher than ours, so that we could increase our tax, maybe significantly, but not as much as Washington, and then still be taking Washington to the dance, as it were?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, that is true. We had... in the last session, the discussion was about 84.5 cents per peg. That was an increase that's being discussed. And that would have put us at parity with Washington. However, Washington at that time had already introduced this restrictions of the no smoking or the Clean Air Act and so on. So at that time, we were getting a whole bunch of business that was leaving the more restrictive environment to the less restrictive environment, and also cheaper environment. So we saw an increase in our revenues accordingly. That, if you equalize it with the tax rate, and you equalize it, of course, now with the restrictions, with the smoke ban, then things would start looking a little more in balance. Now, we have more control that probably they don't. And the issue of the tribal smoke shops looms big in Washington, because they have a lot less control on that. On the other hand, here in Oregon, we have more agreements with the tribes that we tax on the same rate and recompensate versus that we everybody taxes a different. So this area has a whole different bunch of places to look into and a whole different policies to consider when you're looking at changing it. And again, Mr. Chair, if you look at the population trend and the taxed PACs, and we emphasize here that these are taxed, which means that things that we know about, and you're looking at about area we're about here. So you see all the decline that is coming with time. I have to confess, I came to Oregon in 1984, January of 1984, although I came from Washington.
it's a foreign
country. Yes. You could see the increase in smoking consumption at that time, right?
Yeah.
And here where you start seeing the decrease is when I give it up. So I have contributed significantly to this. The other tobacco products. Sorry, Representative Riley, does this come close to answering what you had in mind?
I heard that too.
Maybe in a different color.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, yes, okay. It does. Thank you.
No, you're way too much.
The other tobacco product is... Other tobacco is everything that is... let's see what other tobacco includes.
moist snuff and dry snuff.
There you go.
There's moist and there's dry. And you probably all know the difference between moist snuff and dry snuff, right? Representative Gelser is becoming an expert in both moist and dry snuff. But I don't think she tried them yet. Well, she knows.
No, but I have them in my office.
Hello, here you go.
You keep samples of this material, huh? Representative Gelser.
Yes, and...
Actually, Representative Gelser is working on a bill for us that may be very, very helpful in dealing with some of the issues that these products raise.
Yes, and tobacco products mean cigars, stogies, plug cut, crimp cut, snuff flower, and you have a whole about 4 or 5 lines of descriptions of what chewing tobacco, all these things that constitute other tobacco products. We tax other tobacco products a little differently than cigarettes. We do them on percentage of wholesale price at 65%. And the 65% is divided to different uses, general fund, health plan, and tobacco use reduction account. This is what we do. This is the dangers of this job. I have to go, and just like Representative Gelser has her own moist snuff samples, I have to go and get my own samples. So the tax on cigars, if you look at it, it keeps going up until in 2002. We put a limit on a per cigar basis. We put a 50 cents limit on per cigar. So all these expensive cigars that go with price and so on, mm-hmm. you have the ceiling to it. And the chair kind of tried to look more into this issue last session, and he probably got a good explanation why there is a good ceiling for that.
Yes, Don McIntyre showed up to explain to the committee why the 50 cent per cigar limit was a good idea.
Yes.
And to threaten us that if we raised it, that he'd probably be buying his cigars somewhere else.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And I guess out of the concern of all that, we just kept it. OTP revenue is about $32.8 million. And this is how it divides. This is a new segment, the Administration and Task Force. This is actually now in law, and it changes the way that the administration is funded. In the past, it used to come off the general fund amounts. Now it's off the top. So everybody pays for it. So just to quickly go through this and get to the other stuff, this is how tobacco revenue looks with different colors of where is the dedication comes from or goes to. This is the general fund piece, and you see that the general fund piece is going down. The health plan, since it came and started getting funded out of tobacco revenue, it's just getting more and more of the lion's share. Master settlement agreements. 47 states got into an agreement with the manufacturers. There has been an annual payment in
perpetuity.
Let's start again. Forever. And this is how the estimated payments look like. This is the way the Master Settlement Agreement looked at that time. These are the annual payments. We have an initial payment of $8.8 billion, and these annual payments. Oregon's approximate share at that time, $171 million. Now, this is what total Oregon gets or expected to get with time. And... I'm sorry, this is an 80, yeah. And then this is an annual amount. So these are the annual amounts of Oregon approximate shares that we get. This is from 2007 to 2017. We're expecting about $823 million. This is a 10-year period. Two kinds of payments, the regular payment and the strategic payment. And the master settlement agreement, of course, and payments was used by the 2003 legislature. Was it the 2003 session? What was it? The sixth special session? When we had the appropriation bonds and started paying for them, and it's going to go all the way to the year 2013. And as you see, in 2013, you have the least amount of payments because it should elapse by then, the payments. But the largest amounts come in the 11-13. This is towards the end of it. This is as it's seen today. These are the amounts also for bonds for the Oregon Health Sciences University. There's two series of bonds that we're paying for OHSU. That's total revenue you have in here. And then these are amounts that are balanced, which are left, I don't know if unspoken for is the right word, but unused at this time. So you have about $100 million gone into this biennium.
The Oregon appropriation bonds was the way we closed up the 0103 biennium, wasn't it?
That is
well, part of that, at least, yeah.
Right.
And as members can see, this method of balancing the budget in that biennium will continue to pay for through 15, or through what, probably 14, huh? 2013, 2014.
Yeah, well, yeah. 2013 is yeah. when it ends, so it will finish in the 13.
It does budget. Illustrate how desperate the legislature had gotten in an environment with no reserves and a huge shortfall to make up at the end of a biennium in order to balance the budget.
That's correct. Now we change color. Remember, this was green and stuff, right? Now we go to alcoholic beverages. This tries to give the sense of how would you say it, party or having fun kind of thing. So we'll talk about beer, wine, and liquor. Now, notice the balloons on the side, please. Beer tax rates. They had stayed stable for a long time, then until 1977. Now, what is that? That's 8.38 cents per gallon. So what does that mean? 8.38 cents per gallon means...
That's a penny a pint, isn't it?
That's probably... Yeah, if in a six-pack or a bottle kind of analogy, I've worked it out for you, Mr. Chair. A gallon is about 128 fluid ounces. A six-pack will come down to about 4.7 cents, six-pack of beer. So a 12-ounce bottle will be about 0.786 cents. So if you drink beer and you sip about an ounce and a half each sip will be you'll be paying about 0.09825 cents. That's about almost 10% of a cent or a mil for each sip of beer that you do. Does that work? So every time you're drinking beer, think that you're paying for... Oh, we'll show you the uses in a minute, but let me put it in... if you compare the states, the excise tax with other states, Oregon is towards the right-hand scale. That's... But starts... The 45 to 48 is about the same. So that's where we are. And, of course, again, if you add the sales tax to it, since we don't have a sales tax, we don't have 51 states, of course, but just because of the
District of Columbia being a distinct entity of taxation. That's why we are 50 and 51. Now, the beer tax, that 1 mil per sip that you pay when you drink beer, it comes as 50% goes immediately to the mental health account, and then the other 50 cents go and divide with the same division rates that the OLCC account divides with, and that is 56% to the general fund, but 56% of 50% is 28%. Counties get 5% and cities get 17% accordingly. Of course, twice that amount if you are looking at the OLCC, as we would see in a few minutes. So the beer tax revenue, it is not that much in, you'd see it's about 7.1, 7.2 million a year. And that's where the general fund amounts and the local amounts of it. Now, we change the background again for wine. I know wine drinkers like this. They like the calm. Nice. And wine has two rates. The regular wine at 67 cents per gallon, and then the dessert wines, that's with 14 to 21% alcohol, that's at 77%. 77 cents. So the same idea is where do we stand, and if you look at us with different states, we are at about 24, 67 cents. And you would see this is Alaska. They have no choice but to drink it. They have no Washington effect.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting to note that states that do not have any wine production tend to tax it at a higher level than states that do. I didn't look, but I assume the same thing is true about tobacco.
Mm-hmm. That is correct, Mr. Chairman, and about beer, too.
And beer. So we must produce a great deal of beer here, since we're the lowest of all the states in the country.
I'll consider this an assignment from you, Mr. Chair, and I'll go find out.
Thank
each
you.
Brewery.
Yes.
There's a new one in my
personal
district,
experience
right down the street.
Personal experience is not required.
Well, Mr. Chair, I feel very close to my field of study that I need to verify all these research. Now, if you look at the sales tax with that, that puts us back to number 47. And as you see in although the idea, some of the beer producing, I mean the wine producing states have a little higher when it comes to sales and rates. But things are a little different with the order. The wine tax revenue is about 8.73 million. Again, mental health gets actually 50%, but the thing is there is the wine board gets 2 cents immediately to, this is for wine research and so on. So that brings down the whole amount. Instead of the 50% for the mental health, it ends up out of the total to be 49%. And so is the general fund, county, and city, and so on. So the wine tax revenue during the time, the Bordeaux represents, this is a coincidence color, Well, how about the champagne then? This is the dessert kind of wine, the 14% versus the table wine. As I said, all of the colors and the backgrounds are a coincidence. Now there must be fireworks. We have OLCC liquor. Well, when you drink liquor, I think things look a little different, a little quickly. Liquor, we tax it differently because liquor is not by sale, but we have what's called markup, and the markup is done by the commission, the OLCC, Oregon Liquor Commission, and they set the markup of how much more. At this time, it's above 100%, about 106. But then when you figure out all the different breaks and so on for the sellers and stores, you start looking at things slightly lower than 100%. But that's how the markup works. The OLCC sales, we also excel in this one too in Oregon. Now remember, we don't produce as much liquor as we do wine and beer. So a lot of the stuff that we bring in, we consume. If you notice, for the first time here, we have sales exceeding population. So you're thinking about something about a case per capita, a case a person. This is for every man, woman, and child in the state. So if you haven't drank your case this year, I was wondering about the same thing. I have a family of four. Right?
In Egypt?
Yeah. Who's drinking my liquor?
Well, Madison, we'll hope that a large proportion of that case that you're referring to is being consumed by tourists who buy it in Oregon and consume it here.
That is one hope, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, and
I was wondering the same thing. How many bottles in a case? Is it 12?
12, yes.
Oh, boy.
So, and not drive.
Representative Berger.
And not drive after.
And not drive, that's yeah. Right. That's right.
So revenue is significant, $422 million. However, the cost of goods is about half of that. Remember the 100% markup? You have licenses. The privilege tax is the wine, beer and wine. Net sales, this is after this stuff, is 32%, and other expenditures are 15%. The distribution formula for the OLCC, the privilege tax takes 2 cents, as we mentioned before, out of the wine tax to the wine board. The balance of the wine tax and the beer tax is divided 50% to the mental health, and 50% goes with the OLCC accounts. OLCC distribution adds the 50% from the wine and beer as the OLCC revenue to it and divides it 56% to the general fund, 10% to counties, 20% to cities according to population, and 14% to cities also, but by formula of the 1977 division of revenue formula that's in ORS 221770.
Could you give us a hint about what that formula does that's different from population?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, this came after the time of when we consolidated all the taxes of the different city. And in order to compensate for the ones that at different time had different thing, basically hold harmless. So that formula would divide accordingly.
Thank you.
So if you look at the total distribution, it's about $155.8 million. This is how it looks like. Basically, the 56% that we talked about, general fund, comes down to about 53%. Cities at 32%. The wine board is slightly 0%. Mental health, 5%. And counties, 9.5%. This is what ends up being distributed. Okay. Well, that's a quick look at how it looks historically. Now, look at that.
So is it true then that most of the money comes from the sale of hard liquor?
That is correct.
Yeah. That's basically the bottom part of these of all of these lines, isn't it? Plus from other parts of it as well.
It's the whole thing, yeah, is primarily driven by liquor sales, liquor revenue.
Right.
The remember wine
because the wine tax and the beer tax are so small that they don't actually collect very much money.
About $7 million a year in general.
Yeah, yes, Representative Bence.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So how does that line you've drawn there track population? Is it an increase in population or is it an increase in consumption over those years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vince, I think the population line you would look at it, it has the same slope. Whether it's the same proportion or not, I think there is an increase in consumption that has. However, we assume, as the Chair was mentioning a few minutes ago, that there's more tourism that is doing it, and they don't expect my children to do it.
First, excuse me, Representative Bailey.
Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
Well, I was simply going to note that the profits that we make on OLCC sales are basically would be the same as an ad valorem tax, wouldn't they? In the sense that the more expensive the bottle is for us to buy, the more money we make on it when we sell it. Isn't that correct? And my understanding is that lately, Oregonians and tourists are buying more expensive bottles.
That is, Mr. Chair, that is true. I also could attest to that.
I see. Thank you. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we move on to the exciting subject of emergency access taxes, looking back across the excise taxes that we have here with relation to tobacco, beer, wine, and liquor, I'm wondering if your tax incidence model gives an indication of where the burden of that of those taxes fall on the income spectrum. For example, I might imagine that addiction and to nicotine is probably less correlated with income than, say, addiction to alcohol. Have you modeled that? And if so, do you have that data available?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, we didn't model that in the through OTIM. OTIM, remember, is a very big numbers kind of thing. However, from other studies, we understand that where the distribution in those consumption patterns are. It seems like tobacco use is concentrated more in the lower income groups than the upper income groups. While drinking, then it becomes a battle of preference, saying, beer drinkers and wine drinkers, they start at different times and different. But of course, with the introduction of the microbreweries, it also have changed the picture of the population distribution again. It is not a working class, if you will, blue collar drink anymore, but it's more of the boutique type of drink. Now, is it possible to model it and through OTIM? And this is probably the idea is how changes in the tax will change the incidence on it, basically, the OTIM. That's what it tells you. So it's an equilibrium. If you shock it, and then how it goes back into equilibrium. That will not show in the distribution of tax as it is today. Mm-hmm. Because that you're not changing or shocking the system in that sense and allowing it to come back into equilibrium.
Pull it, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Would it be correct to say, though, that within a class of consumers of a specific type of product, that there might be, the preferences obviously are not homogenous across the consumers, and the extent that there's a difference in price on that particular product, you might see some consumers easily substituting to other products for whatever their enjoyment of that product is, whereas other types of consumers within that class of consumers might not choose to or have the ability to substitute to other types of products. And so would it be correct to say then that the incidence of the tax would tend to fall more heavily on those consumers that have less of an ability or a desire to substitute away from that product?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, that is correct. Now, in addition to all the correct description that you've had. Remember, this is a tax on vice or sin, if you will. The problem with taxes on vices, and the more virtuous you get, the less tax revenue you would have, because if you're saying I'm taxing a bad thing, so if I, the incidence, if I increase the tax, I will reduce this and I will control and incent different behaviors. The more you push people to
consume less of different classes in general, the less revenue you would have. Unlike your general sales tax, let's say. Both are regressive because they're, you know, sales tax, and it seems like lower income spends more in consumption out of their income on goods than upper income, where they tend to save more. So they're both regressive, but in the same time, the distinction here is between the general consumption tax, where you hit almost everybody, and these taxes are a tax on choice of doing so.
Thank you.
Okay. Finally, in case just that all that drinking did something to you, we'll have 911 emergency. This is the quick or the brief history of 911. It started at 81 at 3%. Now we test it at 75 cents per month per circuit. Circuit means everything, cell phone, everything that actually connects. So with the introduction of cell phones increasingly into our uses, you could see how this revenue has climbed so quickly with time. 911 revenue is used by the different emergency 911 centers, basically. And it is at, about $40 million a year. Now, at this point, we reach the transportation. This is fuel taxes. And many of you probably have seen or attended the thing that we had at Willamette with all the discussions about transportation issues and so on. But quickly to look at fuels taxes, this is how we tax fuels at 24 cents. And so is diesel too, but with the weight mile tax, we for the heavy vehicles, just a reminder, this is how fuel tax excuse me, looks when you adjust it to inflation. This stayed the same at 7 cents for a long time. Then we went through a period of increase and then stayed the same at 24 cents for a long time. This is how it looks if you put it in 2008 dollars. So if you, it's still at 24. The highest you were at any time is 43 cents in about the late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. And with the increases that we've done until 93, it was at 35.9 cents of today's 24.
And this is, what adjustment are you using? Is it a CPI adjustment or a road construction inflator adjustment or what?
This is actually more of a personal consumption adjustment, Mr. Chair, since the fuel tax is something that the consumer pays for.
Right.
And it is not necessarily related to the uses yet. So the choice here was a consumption.
Let me ask you, try again and see if I'm looking at the green line, and you've made some kind of an inflator in there.
Right.
To adjust it to 2008 dollars. What is the inflator you use?
The personal consumption deflator.
Okay, thank you. I keep learning new things every day. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I know there are a vast array of CPI indexes.
That's
so
right.
Were you using the, which one were you using?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the personal consumption deflator is a series within the deflators that we have. So there is the GDP deflator, the personal consumption. At every level of the national accounting data, there is an appropriate deflator. This, if you're looking at that personal consumption statistics, when they deflate them, they deflate them accordingly. And that takes away what is some of the descriptions or the criticism from what the CPI and the PPI and so on. So this at that level is the personal consumption deflator.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Right. I was talking more geographical. Is this the Northwest one, the Western United States one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Evans, no, this is the national.
Thank you.
And how is it different from the one that we're more likely to be used to, the one that's published in the newspaper all the time, the CPI?
Well, the CPI, that would be too easy for me to use, first of all.
Yes.
Right?
I certainly agree with that.
Well, of course, the CPI or any deflator, Mr. Chair, is a basket of goods. So, now the CPI, for example, has different segments within its goods, such as, let's say, housing. Housing plays a big segment out of that CPI. Now, it is not every day that you go and buy a house. So different segments, whether they put the housing components, how much they put into it is the kind of thing that personal consumption deflator tries to get out of.
Very good. Thank you. The point is, if I understand it, is that in order to actually raise the kind of money in terms of usable funds, we would, as we were getting in 1968, we'd have to almost double the gasoline taxes. I think you said it was 43 cents, based on your deflator in 1968, and 24 cents is the nominal amount, which of course is what we're collecting.
That is true, Mr. Chair. This is if you just want the now, if you compare this, and we could do that, if you compare this with how much or what's the percentage of personal income that fuel costs represented out of each personal budget, if you will. Now that gives you a different number too.
Correct.
So yeah. How you want to measure that depends on what you're trying to look at. Whether you're going to, your preference is to see the percentage of your disposable income that goes to fuel consumption or transportation, and how does that compare to how much you pay? And is it good for it to go down, and how much is it? What is the appropriate amount for it? What's the right percentage, if you will?
And if you're treating it as a user fee, right, then the number would be different again based on the cost of maintaining the roads.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
Now, we are at fuel tax revenue, and this is how fuel tax revenue. You could see that fuel tax revenue kind of stabilized it. And here you see a slight tick downwards. There's a lot of talk about the fuel tax revenue, and that the fuel tax revenue is becoming quickly part of the past. I don't know if that is exactly true at this time, but it's a different use for different things. And now, in a few minutes, I'll get Jim Witte talk to you about the alternatives to fuel tax revenue. But quickly, weight mile taxes. This is how weight mile taxes go. They're on graduated on the amounts of damage that they do and how much axles you put on your truck. If you do less damage to the road, you get lower tax rates. And new taxes are probably quick, but if I could get, with your permission, Mr. Chair, Mr. Jim Witte from the Office of Innovative Finance to come and talk to you.
That'd be great.
What he and Jim is an old. He's not old, but he's an old friend.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm pleased to have the opportunity to introduce this topic to a revenue committee.
And for the record, please identify yourself.
Jim Witte, the manager of the Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding at the Oregon Department of Transportation. I presented this topic to the transportation committees in both houses 8 or 9 times. And so this is a good thing to do to the revenue committee finally. And now there are some slides that the chair and Representative Reed have seen before. I have some new slides for you.
Thank you.
Keep you entertained. This whole effort began 8 years ago when the legislature passed a bill creating the Road User Fee Task Force, and the members were appointed by the governor, the Senate president, and the Speaker of the House. There were four legislators on that task force, one from each caucus. That helped when things got confusing later on, because those members could answer questions. I want to explain the system that we tested in the pilot program first, very briefly, and then go into the two big issues that the public has raised with us and how we have managed those, and then talk about where things are going. So, first, the system that was tested in the pilot program in Portland from 2006 to 2007. This system was basically identified by the task force. They wanted to do a mileage-based charge to replace the gas tax. So it wasn't designed to create more revenue. That's a legislative decision at a later time. It was simply designed to replace the gas tax. So now the gas tax is an excellent tax as far as its characteristics, especially the fact that the operating costs are so low, about $1 million a year for a $415 million revenue benefit. So that's hard to match. What we decided to do after tallying costs for various alternatives is to use modern electronics to try to reduce the cost of operations as well as the cost of compliance. So the first decision was to use put a device in the vehicle that could locate itself. So we use a locator, and then so that we would not be able to tax miles outside the state. It would simply be Oregon only. And this locator is essentially a receiver of signals from satellites. So you have signals coming down from the satellites, and then you have coordinates identified in the device so that outline the state of Oregon. And then as the motorist drives around in the state of Oregon, the miles are tallied from the odometer in the device. Then at the fuel pump, there is a mileage reader that simply reads the mileage data from the device. And it simply totals. So an Oregon total and an out-of-state total are the basic zones that would be transferred. That data goes into a point-of-sale system at the fueling station. And then the information that's on the slide there is shared with the central computer that would be at ODOT. So you know the identification of the vehicle, the mileage totals for each zone, and then the fuel purchase amount. Those are the three things that would be known.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a third-party person could look at my gas receipt at the gas pump and tell how much I'd been driving in Oregon and if I'd left the state and how many miles I'd driven in another state. My gas receipt would give a stranger or the gas pump person some idea of my travels just by the mileage calculation in and out of zone.
Let me show you the receipt that we use in the test. The mileage rates are applied at the central computer and then sent back to the point-of-sale system where the receipt is presented. And this works just as fast as a credit card transaction. We tested it that way. As you can see, you have the VMT fee, vehicle miles travel fee, mm-hmm. listed there. Not the number of miles, but simply the charge itself. And then in this case, the fuel tax is deducted from the charge. So it rolls up into a fuel purchase amount. So the motorist simply does one simple thing differently than they did before. They pay something differently.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Perhaps I didn't ask the question correctly, and looking at this receipt, it makes it easier for me to ask the question. If I look at this receipt, I could tell how much time this customer that I don't know had spent driving at a certain time of day, rush hour. I could tell how many miles that person had driven or units in Oregon and how many out of Oregon. So, for example, if I wanted to know if my son was traveling across the Washington line so he could pay more for cigarettes, I could potentially figure that out by looking at his gas receipt. Or if I was a person living with a loved one that was trying to get to a domestic violence shelter on the other side of the state line, I could perhaps figure that out by looking at this gas receipt to see that this individual had crossed a state line and come back in, just by looking at the receipt.
Well, that minimal information would be known, yes. No precise locations at all.
Except for in Oregon and out of Oregon.
Excuse me just a moment. I understood you to say that the items called rush hour in Oregon, non-Oregon, and no signal have to do with the payment to be charged.
Yes.
Not the mileage. So you could have, this receipt would be generated whether you had a lot of miles outside of Oregon or 0 miles outside of Oregon, exactly this way, wouldn't it?
The way we tested it, Mr. Chair, yes.
Thank you. So it would show, because we don't charge for mileage outside of Oregon, it would show a zero in either case for non-Oregon.
Mr. Chair, there would be a zero charge for miles driven outside of Oregon,
right.
Yes.
So the receipt doesn't tell you whether there's any driving outside of Oregon or not.
Yes. Now, the database would.
Right.
Be clear.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Representative Riley.
Change the subject slightly,
yes,
but doesn't this really generate a huge Washington effect? People coming over from Washington to fill their gas tanks and not paying anything in taxes in Oregon or in Washington?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, that is one of the fundamental things I want to communicate today. There's enormous flexibility for the legislature to resolve those issues whichever way it wants. For example, the gas tax could be maintained. In fact, probably would be maintained because this thing would take a while to phase in for vehicles that are not properly equipped. And so it could be perpetual for vehicles that say, even if the entire United States adopted the system, from Canada, they would pay the gas tax here because they would not be identified as a mileage fee payer.
And the device that's contained in the pump would tell you whether or not the vehicle had an operational machine that contained and transmitted this information.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's what we tested was, in fact, both types of vehicles came to the stations that we employed in the test, and some were mileage fee payers. They were identified as such, and then the rest of them were gas tax payers, and they paid the gas tax. That was one of the fundamental systems that we tested, and it worked.
Thank you. Does that get at your question?
It does. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Brandt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The picture we're looking at is simply an illustration. You could delete all of that information, and then folks could go home and pull up the information on their computer if so wished. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I'm not sure about the computer question, but presumably if a legislature wants to, they could make this roll-up of the charge embedded in the price paid without transparency. We thought transparency was important for the pilot test, and so you could have more transparency if you like, but this is a continuum. Where do you want to be on that continuum?
Thank you. That raises another question. So there's a database that I could access from my computer and other people in my household could access that. What kinds of limits are there on who in a household can access the information about a particular vehicle?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, no one could access the database we used. But again, those are controls that a legislature could work with to decide how much access or no access they would want to have.
Mm-hmm. The database exists.
It does appear that you have some additional material later on the privacy issue. So perhaps we'll go ahead and maybe we'll get to some of those questions.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative.
Now, working with this now over 7 years, there are two big issues that the public brings up. We're aware of them and have been aware of them for quite some time. Privacy and the rate structure. Privacy, a lot of people, here's the earlier slide, but a lot of people think that there's a signal going back up from the device that to the satellite so that the satellite can track them around. And in fact, no system exists like that at all. There is no signal going out from the device up to the satellite, no information going back up. Now, some GPS systems, like a cell phone, this one here, has a GPS chip in it, and it can, in fact, you have a map, and I've located this right here, right now. So you've probably seen this. This requires a signal, not only receipt of a signal, but a signal going back out. And presumably, I suppose, it could be tracked. A lot of people have these. But what we did in this for this system is we said, we don't want to know where people are. So we eliminated any kind of pinging, regular pinging or transmission device going out from the device. So this is simply a passive device, like a television or a radio that receives signals. Television, you can see this, the television screen, what's going on there, but nobody can look in to see you. This is how this works. It's passive. We did that on purpose because we wanted to eliminate the privacy issue. Now, there's a perception still out there. I want to recognize that, but in fact, we eliminated the privacy issue. Now, what we also did was eliminate any kind of travel history like a navigation unit creates. So there is no travel history in the device. It's simply erased as the miles are tallied. I don't know about a travel history for this. I've never been able to access it. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is one. The point here is...
There are systems that are designed to allow a 911 operator to tell where you are when you call from a cell phone, and presumably that's because your cell phone is sending some kind of information about its location.
Well, there's a cellular pinging.
Yeah.
It's cellular. There is no such thing in the vehicle device.
Right. Thank you.
But there could be.
Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, we learned... last session or session before, I forget which, that we already have in our car, almost all of us, a location device.
Mm-hmm.
It already exists in our car. We just don't know it yet.
Mm-hmm. My car certainly tells me where I am. And so there has to be some kind of a system for the car to be able to know that.
Well, even if it didn't tell you that it... The manufacturers placed in almost all new cars a device which gives them information about where you are and what you did in the last few seconds before an accident.
Mm, yes.
Yeah.
So there's already, you know, GPS devices in almost everyone's car tracking where they're going, and we just don't know about it.
Oh, Representative Reed, and then Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, I remember reading about some other cities that have done some things with congestion pricing as far as going in and out of certain zones. Am I hearing you correctly that that's not possible with this system?
It is possible. Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, it is possible to do congestion pricing this way. There's a way to create a temporal zone. So, say, during rush hour, miles could be registered that way. And within a geography as well as a temporal zone. But that's a separate question. A legislature could say we want to do a per-mile charge and we don't want to do congestion charging. It's just simply the option the legislatures have.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
That makes sense. But how would the time part make sense to me, but how would the geographic part work if you're not able to tell where
Yeah, I don't have a slide for this, but let me explain it. We actually tested this, and we used the boundaries of the Metropolitan Planning Organization, Portland, for that. And so from 7 to 9 in the morning and from 4 to 6 in the evening, during that particular geography, motorists entering that period were charged on a per-mile basis a lot higher to test congestion pricing. It's called area pricing. And it worked very, very fluidly and easily.
So one follow-up, Mr.
Yes, please.
So essentially that you do need to know some information about location. It's just in a broad kind of piece if you're in and out of that large area. Is that right?
Well, there was no precision on where they were or when they entered. It was just that you were in this zone, this temporal zone and geographic zone, and it totaled those miles during the times between your fill-ups.
Okay. So you have a readable clock in the device,
yes.
And therefore you can tell the machine in the device when you're in this zone during this time, traveling on, and the car's in operation, you're going to be charged at a different rate than if it's a different time or if you're not in the zone.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're outside of Oregon, that's the zero zone.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, Representative Bailey's car.
Representative Reed and I are on exactly the same page. That was my question. So follow up to his question here. Beyond a simple cordon model, could you have it down to the point where you could actually measure real-time congestion within a specific corridor and vary pricing with that congestion in a way that doesn't need to transmit specific location data back to the GPS unit, but it's simply the GPS unit coming back down, or does it have to be two-way in order to enable something beyond a cordon system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, let's talk about this privacy continuum. I hope I can get there with this. The Puget Sound actually tested something similar to what you're talking about. They used a GIS map that would lay out the coordinates of a roadway. They actually had that pinging going out so they could follow the cars around. So their device was more capable than the one we used. Presumably, you don't have to have that because you don't have to have the tracking, but you could have the map so that the you would know when a vehicle could have their miles measured on a particular roadway. Now that you're getting more granular there, so more information is known. We eliminated all of that identification of roadways. It was simply you're inside a polygon. But the Puget Sound study, as this continuum shows you, did identify the roadways. But then, this is an option that a legislature has. Where do you want to put yourself on the privacy continuum?
Yes, please.
My understanding of the PSRC study was that part of the data that was transmitted back was to enable a model that would calculate what happened to driving patterns at the same point.
Yeah.
And so what I'm hearing you saying is that it's perhaps that data isn't fundamental to the operation of the system as a charging device, but that was a choice that they made in order to gather certain kinds of data, but you could do it without going all the way over there on the privacy spectrum. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, that is correct. They ran their test to prove and test congestion pricing. That was they wanted a maximum amount of data to be able to validate that. We tested a system for gathering revenue, and so we only went with the minimal elements required to gather revenue and retain a minimal ability to audit.
Thank you.
Is what those three pieces of information that I mentioned earlier that transferred. You have the identification of the vehicle, the gallons purchased, and the miles. With that, you can identify anomalies and then audit. So if there's tampering, some weird, odd thing in the device, you can identify that and then go audit the person. But it's a minimal information. We wanted to get as far to the left as possible. Conceivably, you can go all the way because you could use a device that resets itself at the pump. But then you lose the ability to audit and also the ability for the customer to challenge a billing. So we went over a little bit to resolve those issues.
Okay. So when you say anomalies, if I may, I think what you probably mean is you know that this kind of vehicle tends to get that kind of mileage, and if it's 10 times that or one-tenth of that, probably something's wrong with the way you've calculated it.
Exactly. Now, if it's a 10% difference,
then you don't.
It's not really an anomaly.
No, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Others? Yes, Representative
Brown. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Off the privacy issue for just a moment, Mr. Chair, back to actually paying the bill at the pump. Today, obviously, if I fill my tank, I pay the cent tax on the however many gallons I buy. If I want to go in and just buy a few gallons because I'm in between paychecks or whatever, I pay a lesser amount. How does that, if I go into a service station under this program and only want to buy $6 or $8 worth of gas because I'm in between paychecks, do I still pay the full continuum of the tax on the miles I've driven?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, the way we tested it, there were cash payers. And that's important to note for creating any system like this is you got to accommodate the cash payers. There's plenty of them. That required a reduction of the gasoline price and then adding the miles on top of the gasoline purchase amount, which could be less than a full tank. So the answer is yes. Now, we've conceptualized the idea of potentially allowing a motorist to defer payment so they could get a billing in the mail. That would cause an added administrative cost they would probably have to carry. But you look for options to like that to be able to accommodate the public and its needs.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, I'm about to move off of privacy into the rate structure.
Yeah, I'm sure, given the conversation that we're having in the committee, that members are going to want to look at the privacy issue a lot more. But I think you've given us a good outline for this morning, unless other people have more questions right now. Thank you. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Most people, when they hear about the per-mile charge, think of a flat rate. Everybody pays the same. And then what happens is they immediately do a calculation in their heads. And you see here on this graph, you have a charge per 100 miles on the left, and then at the bottom you have a miles per gallon, which basically identifies certain types of vehicles. So if you have a flat charge, and you're comparing this to the gas tax, the arc of the gas tax is pretty well known. If you have a low fuel efficiency vehicle, you pay a lot more in the gas tax, and if you have a higher fuel efficiency vehicle, you pay a lot less. So what happens, though, is they do this calculation in their head, and they find out that the losers are the upper end, the fuel-efficient vehicles, and that offends people, particularly if they drive those vehicles. And but you can get them to say, well, okay, you have a minimum responsibility that required for you to use the road system, and you can get most people there. But then they think about the other side, and they say, but I can't let those guys get an advantage. That's just not so. This is the struggle. Now, because this involves computers, a legislature can create any kind of rate structure it wants. Formulas are just abound, because not only does it involve computers, but we can have access to a database that identifies the vehicle and its characteristics. It already exists. So,
The manufacturer tells us how much a vehicle weighs.
And the fuel efficiency rate.
And their fuel efficiency, yeah. Yes.
So I have a couple of possibilities here for consideration, but they're simply not proposals. They're simply something for you to consider. You could establish a multiplier that is assigned a particular type of vehicle. And I chose 42 miles per gallon and above as the base multiplier of 1.0. This creates a flat upper end that maintains sustainability of the revenue system, no matter what happens with fuel efficiency in the future. And then, as you see, you go down to lower fuel efficiency values and you end up with a similar arc to the gas tax that you have there. But anything can be done like this. This is simply an illustration. Another possibility, by the way, I chose 42 miles per gallon because I drive a jet of diesel that gets 42 miles per gallon.
Okay.
Another possibility is to simply maintain the gas tax once you go below this midpoint of around 20 miles per gallon. They could still be those vehicles could be charged a congestion charge because they could have the devices in the car, but you simply default to the higher, and that's very possible. So it gives you two options for resolving this flat rate concern people have if a legislature wants to resolve that concern. On the other hand, perhaps the flat rate is what a legislature would want to do, but it's up to policymakers.
I can't imagine it.
Okay. Now, we tested this. We used prototype equipment, and prototype equipment is not what you build a system from. You have to take it to commercial viability, and that's the next step. We tested these receivers of satellites. We tested uploading the data via wireless reader. We have to confirm that makes sense. We also have to confirm that the public will accept a receiver of satellite signals in the vehicle as a locator. They may not. And if that's the case, we have backup ideas available. So I want you to know that we're not stuck on GPS if we can go some other places. But GPS is so flexible and viable that you want to consider it before you reject it, because the other options are not as effective. So all this finalization of systems has to occur. We did not resolve the security issue. That was not part of the test. Our test was designed to prove concept. And security has to be resolved. And to do that, we have to work with the auto manufacturers to design the devices into the vehicles. Retrofitting is extremely problematic. We don't recommend it. The mere thought of going up into some of the Coast Range mountains and trying to find people's cars does not appeal to me. I grew up in Coos County, so I know those people. so there's a lot to do.
Roblin.
The next step. Do I have a Coos County representative?
Not in the room.
Sorry. Yes. Well, I'm very fond of those people, too.
Yes, of course. As are we all.
The rate structure issue can be resolved easily by a legislature. The privacy protection issue is a big challenge because we have to communicate that we have resolved privacy to the levels expected by the public. So that's a big challenge and a communication challenge. You might be interested in this. In the last couple of years, a number of states have popped forward with great interest on this, in this topic. Oregon is the only state that has completed a pilot project and completed some great analysis on this. But other states are coming forward. You see the red states that are proposing pilot projects, and some of them have actually come forward in the media about this. And so they're joining us and assisting us in our communications with the public. And Ohio just had an article today on this, as a matter of fact, and Colorado as well. The governor of Idaho has proposed self-reporting, which is manual reporting of data, which the governor doesn't know will not work, but at least they're starting to think about it, as well as North Carolina and Rhode Island. Governor's commissions have proposed similar sorts of thing. But we've also had extensive contact with the yellow states as well, who are investigating this, state legislatures or DOTs in those states. So there's a lot of interest, and I've testified in front of the House subcommittee, U.S. House subcommittee on highways and transit on this topic in July, and I just had a meeting with the chairs of the transportation committees in the House just last week in Washington, D.C. So there's a lot of interest in Congress as well. We've made a recommendation to Congress about how they should proceed. We believe that to make this work well, there should be a national investigation rather than have it go state by state. We've made our contribution, but we really think that the Fed should take it over to make this thing work. We have to deal with national industries. That's difficult. And the thought of trying to drag motor companies to the table to work on this in Oregon is daunting, but the Feds could do it very easily. And so we've also proposed an approach that has a timeline for development, and then our work could then line up with that timeline. So that's where things are going. There's a lot of excitement in the nation about this, and we're happy to have made the contribution.
And a technologically standardized system deals with Representative Riley's first question, too, very neatly, in that every state could have a system to deal with this issue using equipment that was standardized and therefore readily accessible.
Yes, we believe that's the best approach.
A station, if you were driving in, most of your driving was in Oregon, but you happened to buy fuel in Washington one day, the system could still charge you the Oregon tax if it was set up that way.
Yes. Yeah.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to your rate structure discussion here, it seems like part of the problem is you're trying to manage a bunch of different things with one tool, and that you're trying to manage, you know, wear and tear on the roads and congestion and, you know, pollution, all with one single tool, and one tool might not do all three things well. And so in that sense, is there a way to modify these devices to, say, I don't know, monitor fuel economy or that sort of thing, to be able to give some feedback to the system about other kinds of pollution externalities or various things that you could manage through a similar system? Could you have one technological system that could be adaptable to all three? I understand that's not what you tested, but would it be possible to adapt it in that way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, the professors at Oregon State University we worked with on the technology say yes, that's possible. And I've actually engaged other technology experts that say it's possible as well. The issue is going to be cost. Using the systems we use, they're fairly inexpensive, and because they involve computers, they're going to be down in cost, way down in cost by the time we actually implement. So that's really the issue. But yes, there's a lot of things you can do. I just wrote a paper on this for the TRB, Transportation Research Board Executive Committee, that lays out all these issues. And the main point I made to them, the central point was, that policy should drive system design, not technology. And at this point, we've done a lot of research, and what we really need is to have work with a committee to define those policies, and then go back and then employ the technology necessary. And then, of course, you loop back because the technology might be limiting it some ways. But we did the best we could with the task force. They were marvelous, and we did have sort of legislative input there, and that helped. But policy has to drive this system.
Thank you.
And is that report available online?
I can deliver it to you this afternoon.
Thank you.
That would be wonderful. That would be great. I wonder if we ought to be exploring some of our national organizations to see if they either are working on the issue or if they ought to be. I'm thinking about NCSL, maybe some.
Mr. Chair, NCSL has a policy that they've delivered to Congress to basically move to mileage-based charges over time.
Okay, great. So they're ahead of us. Good.
And they're not the only ones either. There's a lot
other questions.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
If I may add, just adding to the point of Vice Chair Bailey, the different tools for the system, where especially we have a system here of charging for use and damage and so on. So it is not inconceivable, for example, to have or to maintain your fuels tax because it rewards different spectrum of the environmental and so on. The fuel tax has, for a long time, been a good, if you will, imitator for user fees. Now, remember, we also had at one time, and Mr. Chair, you might remember, we had different issues with payments for user fees that were trying to adjust for hybrid vehicles. Remember, the hybrid vehicles, when they start coming out, they are not going to use as much fuel, and therefore we thought that the best thing is for them to pay for their use by increasing the registration fee. And registration fee for hybrid vehicle at that time was $100 versus the $30 for the regular vehicle, and it's just because to pay for user of the highway. That did not go very well with both environmental concerns, saying, well, you're punishing the environmentally conscious. And at the same time, it didn't go very well also with the incentive on the other side. But we were trying to give also at that time, the policy was to give incentive with income tax, to give them a break on the income tax, at the same time charge them more for the highway in order to isolate this unit of use. However, that was repealed and changed. So it's also perception of where the policy wants to go sometimes makes a big difference for you and the decision that how you're going to go with this.
Thank you. And thinking it through carefully is important. Yeah. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
There's a question at the other
end. Oh, sorry. Yes.
Mr. Mazza, this whole discussion of trying, the whole underlying premise of this, trying to get the people who use the roads to incur the costs. I think it's interesting that today we started our discussion with tobacco taxes, and I would just like to say that I hope that same kind of theory drives our analysis in that regard, and I look forward to working with you to look at those numbers and try to better understand how to make sure that those who are making the rest of us pay the costs are in turn incurring them.
Thank you. One more section, and then we're finished for this morning.
Yes, Mr. Chair, a quick one, actually.
Yes. Not compared to the amount of time it took to get it adopted, but...
that is true. So...
Before we lose any more members of the committee, while you're setting up, let me just point out that because of some scheduling issues, we will not be meeting on Monday, so that that 8 to 10 slot is open. I am trying to schedule appointments with every member of the committee personally for us to talk for half an hour about the committee agenda. And I have a couple of slots still available on that during that Monday time for those who might be interested. Have your staff get in touch with mine, and we'll talk. Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, the last thing I want to talk about, the hotel motel tax or the transient lodging tax. This was a whole process, came through the vehicle of House Bill 2267 of the 2003 session. Basically, it imposes a statewide 1% tax on transient lodging, and this is, it came in the 2005 and improved it for, it's not only hotel and motel, but it's also the different arrangements for transient lodging. So that's why it is a little wider than that. Department of Revenue administers this tax, and it takes about 2% for its administration. The rest goes to the Tourism Commission. It does the fund the tourism marketing and so on for the state, and encourages tourism. However, the providers of the lodging who collect the tax, they're allowed a 5% allowance to keep for acting as an agent of the state in collecting the tax. The starting January 1st, 2004, they would pay quarterly, and if this also preempted all the other local taxes, and said if any local, it grandfathered local taxes in. However, it says if any local government is to impose a new tax, this new tax has to be 70% dedicated to tourism and tourism improvement in that sense. So at that time, what we estimated in LRO, the impacts of this tax, we said in the 03-05 we'll get about 16 million, 20 million in 05-07, 07-09, 29. How did we do? First year came, started really slow, and we didn't do as well as things should have been. However, in 2006, we got about 9.2 million, and 2007, 10 point, that's for the biennium, about 20 million. That was net, of course, after we took the collection cost. So I think for that sense, we came pretty close. In 07, 09, fiscal year 08, it's about 11.84. That's also coming pretty close. And because this is a new experiment, it was important for us to see if it is tracking of what we thought it should be. So the way we were able to look at that is we looked at the different transient lodging taxes in the state. There is local ones, an effective rate around the state, if you take this whole thing and average it, is about 7.7%. This is in addition to the 1% that we have in the state. And it collects for the local governments about $100 million a year. And that brings us to the conclusion of our presentation, and Mr. Chair, the lottery presentation would come also on your first time next week.
Thank you.
Tuesday.
Very, very helpful. I will repeat this and not what I'm about to say on Tuesday for the benefit of the other committee members, but I simply want to note that our work is about to pick up. We will be getting to some of our first bills next week. We may actually hold some work sessions on, I guess we're having work sessions on some bills on Thursday, potentially at least. And so our period of review is about over. And I'll note that again on Tuesday morning. Those on the committee who thrive on controversy and excitement will perk up and be ready to work.
Have their chance.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anything else this morning? No? All right. We will then stand adjourned until Tuesday.